You're on 101.9 High FM. I'm Kathy Kayla, and I'm very, very pleased to be joined in studio by singer, songwriter, Alexander Clare, aka Alex Clare.
That's my name.
Welcome to High FM.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to South Africa.
Thank you. It's lovely being here. Wonderful place.
How are you coping with the weather?
Oh, it's fine. Like, we had English weather last night here, you know, so.
Do you have storms like that in England?
Yeah, not with the lightning and the rain coming in sideways, but we definitely get bad weather. Yeah, for sure. We're kind of famous for it. It's like when it's a sunny day, you know, it's the most amazing thing. Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
And I think that the personality of the people reflects that.
Totally. Yeah, English people are just depressed the whole time. Then it gets sunny and everyone's like, oh!
That's why they drink so much.
Pleasant. Yeah, possibly. That might be the reason.
Alex, you've got an amazing story which really touched me when I heard your YouTube recording.
Okay.
And I wonder if I could press you to tell us that story.
Press away.
So when did you get into music?
I started playing music actually from a very young age. I picked up the trumpet, I think I was about 7 or 8. And then I started playing drums when I was about 11 or 12. And I was playing in bands, playing drums. Then as I sort of in my mid-teens, I was playing in a band, doing backing vocals while drumming, and the singer realised that my voice wasn't necessarily better than his, but it was definitely louder. And he got very frustrated and said, you know what, you should probably just sing. And I was always around instruments, so I picked up a guitar and started like dabbling and being able to, using it to write music.
That was good advice.
Yeah, it was quite good advice.
I'd like to thank him.
Thank you, Paolo. I appreciate it, man. That was his name. So
thanks, Paolo.
Yeah, so and then I was gigging and like playing around London and the UK, just doing acoustic stuff. And then I got a publishing contract for writing music, actually, for a small publishing company in the UK. And then eventually signed a record deal to record and make an album with Iron Records. Yeah, about 6 years ago now. Yeah, 5 years ago.
Island Records, they handle some big artists.
Yeah, they've had a couple of big ones in the time. You know, Bob Marley, he was signed to Island, U2.
U2.
Mumford and Sons.
Not familiar, yeah, Mumford, not familiar with going. Any of them.
Yeah. Me. Yeah. Yeah.
And you had quite a good relationship with them? Look, I mean, they signed you, so how bad could it have been?
It was all right. I think when they signed me, they didn't realise, you know, what being an Orthodox Jew actually means. And that means, you know, keeping Shabbos and keeping kosher. And when you explain to a record company, who most people would give their right arm to be a part of, that there's certain days in the week where you can't work with them, they can't really, they
can't relate.
Nah, it kind of messes with their paradigm a bit. Like, hang on, there's this guy who's a musician and he's not going to play music on a certain day of the week.
Were you always Orthodox?
No. Yeah, I'm barely Jewish. But no, not Orthodox growing up. I think it wasn't a matter of being like reform or not. It was just the case of in the UK, there's not really a reform movement as such, but it was just unaffiliated, just floating around.
Like many Jews.
Like most Jews, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to have certain life changing events, and your focus has to shift till you sort of wake up to it. It was always there. I always had like a sense of emunah my whole life. And I would go to shul occasionally as a kid. You know, if I had an interest in it. But I grew up in a not particularly Jewish neighbourhood in London. There's very few Jews there, and it's very hard to develop a Jewish identity until I moved to North London, when suddenly it was like, oh, wow, okay, there's like other Jewish people in the world. Amazing. And, definitely my curiosity got aroused and started learning Hebrew properly and started learning a little bit of Torah. And for far too long, I was, took on little things, one at stage by stage, until I was Shomer Shabbos and Shomer Kashrus. And, yeah, that was around the same time I signed my first publishing deal. And I was like fully Shomer Shabbos and fully, Shomer Mitzvahs by the time I signed my major record deal.
And this was with Island Records?
With Island Records, yeah.
And how did that work out?
So you may be familiar with the story, but it was...
I think many people aren't, and I think that it's okay. A very, very inspiring story. It's all of our story, or potentially.
Potentially. So when I signed, I told them I was Shomer Shabbos, and I explained basically what it meant, but they didn't quite understand. And then before too long, Pesach came, and I was offered a tour with a fairly successful female singer in the UK. And when I told them, it was during Pesach, And I told my record label that there's not really, I can't really do it. There's 2 days of the Yomim Tovim, then there's Chol HaMoed, where there's a Shabbos in the middle, and then Tumadei Yontov. So I could like, there's 1 day of the tour I might be able to play, but otherwise I can't come on tour. And it's then when they realise, okay, you've just turned down. You know, at that stage, her album was number one, and you know, they were generally a bit confused how I couldn't go on the road, you know, with the biggest, like, flavour of the month. And then, yeah, a few more months came around, and for some reason, after I released my album, every piece of promo that came in was on a Friday night. And when you're starting out in the music industry, you have to take every opportunity you have.
Sure.
You know, and they're few and far between, and you just need that one amazing opportunity, but they seem to always be coming in on Friday nights and Saturday days. So I had to keep saying to my record label, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it. And before too long, they got very frustrated, and the month of Tishrei came along with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and then Motzei Yom Kippur, they sent me a text message telling me to call them straight away. You know, the most heaviest day of the Jewish year, and then you see this, like, message, call them right away. So I called them right away, and they said that they had an opportunity for me that was incredible, and it was the following Thursday. Now,
Sukkos.
Yeah, Sukkos. So Yom Kippur that year was on a Shabbos, and then Sukkos was the following Thursday, and yeah, I was stuffed.
So you got Sukkos, Shabbos. Yeah, another 3 days that you can't work.
Absolutely, and not only that, but the concert was on the first night Sukkos. They didn't want me to play. There was no way out of it. It was like a BBC live broadcast thing, and they were like, you know, amazing opportunity. And I was using the Art Scroll Machzor that year, and there's an amazing story by Onatane Toikef about a man called Amnon Amains. And it's kind of a gory story. It's really heavy about the piyut of Onatane Toikef. And it basically says that the guy who wrote it was a guy called Amnon Amains, who was a Rishon, one of the people who contributed to the commentaries of the Talmud. And said that basically he was friends with a local bishop, and the bishop said to him, Amnon, convert to Christianity or I'm going to kill you. And Amnon said, give me 3 days to think about it. And automatically he regretted it so much that, you know, he'd even, just to buy himself time, he'd tell him something. And like, if I hadn't read that story, I probably would have said to my record company,
there and then,
you know, there and then, give me 3 days. But yeah, like, you know, I it was like such a hashkacha protis, you know, a little bit of divine providence that I had to read that story that day as opposed to Davin. So I read that story and I was like, you know what, guys, you're going to have to do what you have to do. And Sukkos came and went and they dropped me. Left high and dry.
Devastating.
It was quite devastating, yeah. I was like, you know, as a musician, you build up to these certain goals in life, and sometimes these goals come and then they pass you by.
But Alex, didn't you find also that as a Balei Tshuva,
yeah,
somebody's reconnecting you, making these really massive changes in your life, in your thinking, in the way that you eat, 100%. In the way that you get dressed, everything is different. Mm-hmm. And one of the most devastating things happens to you. What did it do to your relationship with God?
So I
did
went,
it have an impact?
Of course, yeah, of course it did. It made it everything a bit unsteady. I went to my rabbi. Everything had been amazing since I started keeping like Shabbos and like kosher. Everything had been incredible. You know, my career had started to pick up, and you know, I was touring and playing, and you know, it was great. And then I went to my rabbi after I got dropped, and I said to him, like, "What do I? You know, this doesn't seem entirely fair. Like, I'd made certain changes in my life because I felt I had to, and I really, you know, felt a strong conviction to do that. And it kind of hadn't really worked out." So he told me about Avram Avinu, and Avram Avinu had to make the Akedas Yitzchak, and how ultimately Hashem gave him a series of tests. And when it came to the Akedas Yitzchak, it was the everything Avram had invested his entire life into raising someone who could carry on this message of kindness and chesed and you know, belief in one God. Everything he invested so much into, and then Hashem told him, Abraham, Shecht Yitzchak, you know, the most precious thing to him. And, you know, as a result of that, we're all here. The decision that Avram Avinu was willing to, like, give up everything, you know, obviously he didn't, thank God.
Jumping off a cliff.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, go on.
Saying, catch me.
Yeah. It's like the Mountain King, for sure. Absolutely. And it's, and you know, it's tough. It's tough because, you know, my rabbi told me the story and he said, you know, you've made the right decision. You've been willing to sacrifice everything that's so important to you for Hashem. And I have no doubt in some way you're going to get Siyata Deshmaya. You know, you'll get like a little bit of help from heaven. I promise, you know, you may not realize it straight away, but it will happen. And I thought that's very nice.
And you said, thanks so much. I can't pay my rent.
Literally. Literally. I was like, okay, but I'm like, you know, Fortunately, my landlord was really friendly. He was a really nice guy. He was like, you know what, it's okay. Let's just like give it a few months. You'll get a job or something, or, you know. And
in and of itself has to have come from God, because landlords do not say that.
Oh, he's a lovely
man. Let's
give
it a few months and see what happens.
Yeah, I had a funny relationship with my landlord. He was like, he's actually a really good friend and kind of a mentor as well. It's like a family I moved in with. And I decided to go to yeshiva, went back to yeshiva, started learning a little bit of Torah. And when I was there, that's when Microsoft got in touch and were like, we want to use your music for our campaign internationally for this new thing. And it started off just in America and the UK, and then it went international. And as a result, you know, the album that Ireland had been, you know, pushing for so long, it hadn't got anywhere, suddenly sold, you know, just under 1 million copies, and the single sold just under 6 million copies. So, you know, a little bit of Siyata Dishmaya.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, amazing.
And how often in life are we not willing to take that plunge?
Yeah, it's tough. It's
because
tough.
Because we kind of overthink it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when you know, you know.
Yeah, you do. And I think when you understand that, it's these moments in life that really make us as human beings and build our connection to Hashem ultimately. You know, it's he gives you a challenge, and if you rise to it, you know, you get a little bit of a pat on the back.
Yeah.
A little bit of a hug.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's
just
a good thing.
Tiny little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, 54 and a half million little hugs.
Yeah.
If you want to know what we're talking about, Alex Clare, who I'm speaking to right now, has many songs posted on YouTube, but one of the biggest YouTube sensations, I think. When did it actually start, Alex? When did it start growing?
Early 2012. It went crazy. It was I was in yeshiva in early 2012, and then it was around that time when it just went crazy. It was funny. I was like staying in this bedroom, sharing my room with a cat and ants in Jerusalem, and like a few like American kids who sort of ended up in Jerusalem. And then from that, I was staying in like 5-star hotels in Germany and America. It was very bizarre. Suddenly, like from 0 to 50, you know, it's crazy.
Not the first time it happened. It happened with Joseph as well.
Yeah, that's true. I think his was over a bit more of a time period, but yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. 54 and a half million hits. I mean, do you realize how extraordinary that is?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a lot of people. A lot of computers in the world.
It's a lot of little hugs. So are you gonna sing for us?
I'm going to sing, yeah.
What are you going to sing for us?
I'm actually going to sing my new single. It's called War Rages On, and it's actually based on David Hashem Uri.
Okay, which is what?
It's one of Tehillim. My Dovid HaMelech, which is basically, there's an explanation on it by someone called the Sfasemus, who said that there's a line in it, but loosely translated, means even though a war comes against me, in this I have trust. And the Sfasemus explained that that means that ultimately when hardship comes against you and you feel like you're really up against the wall, that's when Hashem is most there. You know, that's the time to have like the most betochen, that is going to be good.
Love to hear it.
Okay.
The war rages on, you'll be at my side through it all. Through hardships unseen, this love survives, fortified. Please don't pass me by. Give the things I do, don't turn your back.
Absolutely beautiful.
Lovely.
Thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Alex, what was the first song you ever learned to play on the guitar?
Oh, first song I ever learned to play was a song called Goodnight Irene by Lead Belly. Yeah.
Do you want to give it a shot?
Oh, it's kind of harsh.
Is it,
yeah,
really?
It's a bit, yeah, I can't. I was like 11 when I first like learned it.
I can't. Not believe... Smoke on the Water. Because no. that's a popular one.
I know. I was never into like noodling, you know. I was like just playing chords.
What do you play when you're just in your spare time? Do you play a lot of...
It's funny, I'm usually writing a lot. Yeah. Like I try and just make songs, and if not, I like Nagunim. Chassidisha like Nagunim a lot. My daughter loves them.
Oi.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. But like the Vekas Nagunim, they're a little bit like slower and moody. And my daughter, you know, we were blessed with a daughter 16 months ago, and she you know, she loves music, and yeah, she loves Shlomo Carlbach.
Everybody loves Shlomo Carlbach.
Everyone loves Shlomo. Yeah, so she really likes these songs, you know, so she's good.
When you're composing, mm-hmm. Do you enter a specific space, like a creative space, almost like a meditative state, or is it
depends on the song? It depends
sparked
on the song,
by something like, that's happened in your day.
Yeah, sometimes it varies. Some days, like, you know, there's no such thing as writer's block. I'm a firm believer that sometimes you just have to like sit down and just write, even though, and something will come out. It may be rubbish, but something will come out. And then there's other songs that come from something, you know, a personal experience or from a much deeper place. And often, more often than not, you'll start just writing something, and then something deep will just pop out. You know, but you have to push yourself, like all things in life. You know, you have to get up in the morning and get on with it. So yeah.
Okay, so do you want to sing us one more song or
let's
not?
Let's sing another song.
You're right.
While I'm here, you might as well. So there was one nigger that actually I really got into when I first became religious. So there was a man called the Divrei Yisroel, and he was an incredible person. He wrote. You know the tune everyone is for Mizmor David, Hashem Ro'i Lo Yechzor. So the guy who wrote that niggun was a man called the Divrei Yisroel, and the story was that he had an ability through music that he could basically leave his body. And there was a story that he was a type 2 diabetic, and they didn't have insulin in those days. He was an incredibly sick man, and his doctor told him that he'd have to leave Modzitz in Poland and go to Berlin for a surgery. And on the way, he became so sick, so much weaker, that his leg actually became completely gangrenous. He had an infection in his leg, completely gangrenous. And when he got to the doctor was like, Rabbi, I'm going to have to remove your leg. But you're so weak that if I anaesthetize you, your heart will stop. So he said, you know, okay, just don't anaesthetize me. It'll be fine. I'll sing a tune. And the story was that he sung a niggun. He sung a tune, and in the process, he, you know, was able to block out complete levels of pain. To the extent that after the surgery, it was during the Franco-Prussian War, and the surgeon went next door to do an operation on a general who'd been injured by a bit of shrapnel, who was crying. And this doctor famously said, you know, there's a sweet old rabbi next door who's just singing a tune when I remove his leg, and they were crying over a splinter.
Hmm.
You know, so he wrote a tune for Yom Shabbaton, which is like one of my favourites, so I'll play that.
Wonderful, and thank you very, very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Mama.